This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday night, August 12, 2020, and this is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ahead tonight, how Bentonville Public Schools are preparing for the unusual school year. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek has that report ahead. Arkansas's Department of Health is reporting more than 700 new cases of COVID-19. The number marks a return to the 700s after yesterday's total was under 400 new cases. At today's press briefing, Governor Asa Hutchinson announced there have been 7 additional deaths, bringing the state's total to 573. He did say there are 21 fewer Arkansans hospitalized today because of the virus than were in hospitals because of the virus on Tuesday. And there were just more than 4,100 test results returned to the state yesterday. The governor says he's signing a letter of intent with the Rockefeller Foundation and other unnamed states to work as a consortium to enhance buying power with commercial labs.
To strengthen our place in the marketplace so that we can give them confidence that they can expand, that they know the demand is there because the states have committed to that demand. And this is a letter of intent that I'll be signing that then, as we get more information about what the state's commitments will be and what states want to join this, then we'll be able to get concrete as to what our expectations are and how that will benefit us.
The governor says after more information about states' obligations is learned, the letter of intent would become a formal contract requiring a commitment to purchase testing supplies. The governor says there is a small list of states that has agreed to join Arkansas, and he expects that list to grow. And the governor says a task force created to make recommendations for fall sports at Arkansas schools, like volleyball and football, has established guidelines and schedules for those sports and will be released soon. Dr. Jose Romero, Arkansas Secretary of Health, says fans' attendance at such events will depend on a case-by-case approval from the state health department.
With any large event, a plan is submitted to the health department and approved individually. There are general guidelines that serve as a framework on which to submit that request. So they're dealt with overall individually.
The governor says a few scheduled charity exhibition games this week could provide clues to what works when a scheduled sports season begins later this summer or in the fall. Today's briefing was conducted on the campus of the University of Arkansas Monticello in the southeastern portion of the state, but the governor did make a reference to Northwest Arkansas, saying a reduction of new cases in the past few weeks in Northwest Arkansas could be an example for the rest of the state.
It was considered a hot spot nationally, and that was the growth of cases in Northwest Arkansas. And because of our concentrated efforts in contact tracing, testing, with the community wearing masks and social distancing, it was just a concentrated effort by the community and said, this is a serious problem that we don't want to get worse and we got to turn it around.
As of this afternoon, there are more than 5,900 active community cases of the virus in Arkansas. The Oklahoma State Department of Health is reporting 9 identified additional deaths from the virus in that state, though none of those deaths occurred in the last 24 hours. There have now been 627 fatal cases of COVID-19 in Oklahoma. Of the 9 recent deaths, 2 were between the ages of 50 and 64. The other 7 victims were in the 65 and older age range. This is Ozarks at Large. Governor Asa Hutchinson recently announced that hundreds of rapid COVID-19 antigen test devices and kits are being distributed to public health clinics across the state. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich recently spoke with Dr. Jennifer Dillahay at the Arkansas Department of Health about the difference between the standard high-precision molecular PCR tests in use since a global pandemic was first declared and the new antigen tests, which are also becoming commercially available.
For 6 months now, the PCR test has been the standard to measure if a patient is positive for active COVID-19 virus. But due to a national surge in demand, tests as well as reagents, the testing chemicals, have been difficult for states to procure, with lab results in some cases taking weeks. because no national testing strategy was deployed in the U.S. by the Trump administration, leaving it to states to coordinate. Governor Asa Hutchinson has been building capacity in Arkansas for both PCR testing and now for rapid antigen testing. Dr. Jennifer Dillahay is epidemiologist at the Arkansas Department of Health.
The molecular test called PCR looks for the genetic material of the virus, and it goes through an amplification process. So if there's just a few copies of the gene that they're looking for, the genetic material, it multiplies those copies, so it's easier to run a test on them to find them. The antigen test differs because it's now looking for proteins of the virus, and it does not go through that kind of amplification process.
The antigen test sampling, similar to a PCR test, requires a nasal swab, but processing results are different.
It's different from PCR tests, and PCR tests, they can run, hundreds of samples at the same time. The antigen test is run one at a time. So they run your test, and it takes under 30 minutes, is some maybe 15 minutes, and you can get the answer of whether you are positive or negative right then.
200 BD Veritor rapid detection SARS-CoV-2 antigen systems and test kits costing over $200,000 paid for with Federal CARES Act funding will soon be available around the state. According to Gavin Lesnick, a spokesperson at the Department of Health, the devices and kits will soon be placed in health units, and K-12 public school systems will be given top testing priority. Both PCR and the Veritor antigen tests have been authorized for emergency use by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control to diagnose acute COVID-19 infection.
So the Arkansas Department of Health will test people for COVID-19 either through right now with a PCR, but in the future for an antigen test. But it's important to know that the antigen tests are designed for testing only people who have symptoms. A PCR test is designed in such a way that people without symptoms could be tested. But the antigen test focuses only on people who have symptoms.
Dillahay says the antigen tests, which are also commercially available, don't require a physician's referral, but patients will be screened for symptoms in order to qualify for testing.
Currently, pharmacies around the state are doing antigen tests, as well as some clinics. I'm aware that the pharmacies may charge $95, or I've heard of another location charging $300, so people should shop around.
Arkansas is now setting monthly testing goals because testing, contact tracing, and isolation work to stop the spread of coronavirus. The rollout of antigen testing, Dillahay says, is also experiencing a backlog due to demand.
Clinics and pharmacies that have these antigen testing machines are having difficulty getting the kits or the materials that they need to run the tests. So these tests are also experiencing some of the supply chain issues that we have been experiencing in Arkansas and around the country, that the companies cannot make the reagents or the testing kits that are needed to run the tests fast enough to keep up with the number of tests that are being collected, the number of specimens that are being collected.
With between 500 to over 1,000 new COVID-19 cases diagnosed every day in Arkansas, Dillahay says it's critical for anyone experiencing symptoms of COVID-19 to get tested immediately.
If they are infected right now and could be spreading the virus, so it's important to either get a PCR or an antigen test. So if it's positive, then you would isolate and keep from spreading the virus. An antibody test is not useful for that.
Coronavirus antibody tests, which require a blood draw, reveal if an individual has been exposed to the virus but experienced little to no symptoms.
Some people feel that they would like to know if they have had the virus, but oftentimes it's because they think if they have positive antibody tests, then they're protected. But that is not necessarily the case. We do not know how long someone is protected if they have a positive antibody test. It could be just for a few months.
Dr. Jennifer Dillehay also warns anyone experiencing symptoms of COVID-19 should immediately isolate until they learn their test results. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And the Arkansas Department of Health is now documenting cumulative COVID-19 antigen tests in the state, which over the past 5 days number 1,830. Governor Hutchinson yesterday also said the state is working to reduce the wait time for conventional PCR test results.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
This is Ozarks at Large. Thanks for being with us on this Wednesday. Bentonville Public School students will be returning to the classroom either in person or virtually August 24th. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek spoke with Superintendent Debbie Jones last week about the district's reopening plan.
In what ways will Bentonville students be returning to school in just a few weeks?
We shared with all families in the district the opportunity to return to the brick and mortar school, which we call blended, or the families could choose virtual and they stay home using our teachers and continue to learn from home. We did call it blended for those returning to brick and mortar because those teachers and the students will be prepared to go home at a moment's notice and be prepared to continue their learning following the same schedule if they have to go home.
So by blended, you mean students are still in school Monday through Friday, but can go to virtual should the need arise?
Exactly. Should we have an outbreak or, for example, we would use for inclement weather, we would continue instruction just following the same schedule. And that's why we named it blended so that they understand there is the opportunity to go home should the district call school.
Have parents already had to make their choice, and kind of how did the breakdown end up with who chose the blended and who chose virtual?
Yes, families were asked to make their choice by July 23rd, and we had 25% of our 18,000 students elect virtual learning, so they will be at home. And our principals are in the process of finishing up scheduling and assigning teachers to virtual and assigning teachers to blended school.
And how did you make those decisions with staff in terms of who would be in the building and who would be teaching the virtual side of things?
We asked teachers to volunteer, the ones that really felt comfortable with teaching virtual. They had the experience back in the spring. And certainly we had some that absolutely excelled with this type of teaching. And so we did have volunteers to be able to do that. And so we were able to fill with enough people that volunteered to do the virtual learning to cover that for the students.
What will school look like in terms of following, you know, masking, social distancing, all these other guidelines that the CDC recommends for returning to school?
Well, I think that's one thing that families are quickly growing accustomed to. And I think sometimes our students are the most flexible. And so a typical day, this typical school day, following the same hours within the day, but from the moment that they get on the buses, then they have the face covering on, and that's K through 12 students. And when they enter the buses, they'll use the hand sanitizer. They will sit together as a family on the buses where possible. We know that we're not able to transport all of those kids and maintain a 6-foot distance. And so that's why it's really important that they wear their mask the whole time. I've seen little 3 and 4 year olds wear the mask as if it's just another school item. So I know that they're able to do it. It will take some adjustment and some positive reinforcement. It will look different for families in the fact that normally we have parents come in to have lunch with their children. And so we're having to really limit our buildings to essential personnel only. Our parent-teacher conferences will be virtual. Our open houses, and those, we always have tremendous attendance at those. Those will be virtual as well. And think of the kindergarten family who are sending their kindergartner for the first time ever, and the anxiety they already feel in sending their baby off. And so we have adjusted the schedule, I think, to be very kindergarten friendly, where the parents have a scheduled time in which they come in. They spend some time with their teacher, their child's teacher, and the child there. They get to know the building. They get to know the teacher. I think that's really important. And then the step two is kind of a gradual release method. We're going to have the parents drop them off at the front and let the kindergartner have about 30 minutes of independent time in the school with their teacher, and they'll return to the parent. And so I think that our elementary teachers and principals have done a beautiful job in recognizing the student anxiety and the family anxiety that they feel right now, and trying to accommodate those needs. We're not sure what some of the events as far as football games or basketball games will look like at this point. So we await further guidance, and we adjust to that as we need to. We're still awaiting guidance on all of our fine arts, the music programs, the orchestra programs, and band, and so forth. Lunches will look different because we have to reduce the capacity in the cafeterias for safety. We will have the 6-foot distance in the cafeterias. So if you think of a junior high lunch where they're all huddled up, normally that's not going to be the case. And that's going to be tough on already very social, a social age group there. And so half the time kids may be having lunch in their classroom, but that won't be exclusive. They'll also have lunch in the cafeteria at times. Students will hopefully get the opportunity to be outside quite a bit, weather permitting, and the equipment, the playground equipment's cleaned several times a day. And so we will try to use as much of outdoor fresh air as we possibly can to get kids outside. So those are some of the highlights. I know there are many, many more.
Is there anything that'll be done differently in the classrooms, or will classrooms stay pretty similar to what they usually are?
Well, we learned anything from the spring. We learned the value of face-to-face interaction. It is honestly the best teaching that can occur. There is something about making that natural connection between the teacher and the student. And so we will continue that. And that's very important. Even for those students that are learning at home virtually, while we did have a lot of recorded lessons in the spring last year, they're going to see much, much more teacher and student interaction through our Google Hangouts, which is like Zoom. They'll have small group interaction with their teacher. If they need a little more remediation for anything, that's going to be small groups, some small groups phonics instruction. And so we have learned that face-to-face instruction is critical. But the second thing, I think education's forever changed. It's now more technical. When students enter, it will be enter the classroom and blended in the brick and mortar building. They'll have a lot more lessons, their assignments disseminated to the students through their Google Classroom. You'll see a paper reduction, not so many pieces of paper changing hands. The library is making some modifications. You'll just see a lot more digital content, but we are not going to replace the face-to-face interaction.
What about masks? Will the school district be providing those, and or do kids have to have their own, and do teachers have to have their own?
We have shared with parents on their supply list that they need to go ahead and purchase and have the students start wearing face coverings in public as much as possible, because all masks are not created equal. And we've had the experience now of wearing them enough to know some are much more breathable, and it's very individualized. And so find the right mask that feels comfortable for your child, something that they can wear considerable amounts of the day. Now, we're going to make every attempt to get a breathing break from the face covering, you know, pulling that down when they can distance within the classroom, outside, when they're eating as frequently as possible. They're really just kind of critical during those hall times, the passing times, the bus times, at times when they're in the classroom and they're all together. So yes, parents and staff are encouraged to certainly find the mask that works best for them. And then we'll have some backup face masks should they forget those.
Have you guys as a district discussed how you'll be disseminating information regarding cases that happen within the school?
Yes, at length we discussed this issue. And I also listened over the weekend to Dr. Romero and a recording where he talked about the state is investing in more contact tracers. And so families have to remember that really the identification of positive cases occurs at either the physician's office. It's critical to get that information to the Department of Health. The job really of tracing rests with those contact tracers, but until they get enough on board, and their goal is to notify us, do the contact tracing, not notify us always, but notify everyone with whom that student or that family or that staff member had direct contact within 24 to 48 hours. Now, we rely upon the families, the students, the staff that tested positive to notify the district. The Department of Health will not always notify us. They won't notify us. The way that we will learn is if our teachers were a direct contact with those students, then the teacher will be notified through the contact tracers. And so, you know, that, and there is absolutely nothing to be ashamed about when you test positive or when you are a direct contact with someone that has. We just really have to practice that personal responsibility and be honest. We deal with it quite often, you know, just reporting to us and then helping us until they have more contact tracers on the ground working. Then we're doing a lot of that within the district right now. But we have incredible personnel and our nurses and our point of contact within the district to help communicate with families. And so they've been very good in reporting to us. If students, I have to stress this with families. If your child has fever, if your child is showing any type of symptoms, and I think everyone knows them now, the sore throat, the fever, the nauseous, body aches, and so forth, don't send them to school. Because truly it could spread in a hurry, and we want to open school and we want to give those kids the experiences. It's critical that we open our doors. It's so far beyond just providing a good education. It is the social time that kids need. It's the structure, the schedule that everyone needs. The staff needs that. The students need that. I need that. It's the social and emotional, it's a mental health support that we provide. It is certainly the meals that we provide for many families. And so it's important that we're here, we're operating. We won't be able to do that unless everyone practices personal responsibility.
What has been sort of the most, I guess, challenging? I'm sure there's so many challenging parts to reopening school during a pandemic. But what has been kind of, I guess, the most challenging part of approaching reopening?
There are so many challenges with it. You know, helping the community understand that we work within certain parameters. We, as a school district superintendent and my board, we don't have the option of not opening school. We're called upon by the governor to open schools daily, and that's what we're doing. And some families that feel strongly that we should not open are a bit upset. And just understanding that we have to be flexible. Teachers love a schedule, black and white, more than anybody else, myself included. But this is the time that we have to exercise maximum flexibility. We are with our students, we are with our staff, and we ask for that same grace within the district because guidance changes. We, you know, our calendar was changed, and so we went back to the drawing board and designed a new calendar. We're just forced to do these things, and we can accomplish it, but it's better accomplished when everyone is positive and works together. So I think that that's probably the greatest challenge, is the inflexibility of some who would like all the answers now, as I would, but we just simply don't have them all. We are well aware that students will experience some anxiety, and we're prepared to deal with that. The one thing that I've repeated over and over again with my leadership is, you know what? You may never hear me say this again, and probably have never. Academic achievement is not priority right now. It's really that keeping people healthy and making students feel connected, reconnecting them with the school is priority number one. Making them feel safe, making them feel like that's where they want to be. That's most critical when we return. And so everyone, when I say we're exercising flexibility, we will get to the lessons and the excellent education, but it is really mental health first. It's comfort. It's all those things that we know that we need to provide in order for children to feel safe.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Bentonville School District Superintendent Debbie Jones speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek about what the coming school year will look like. The downtown Springdale Outdoor Dining District opens to the public today. The City Council approved an ordinance establishing the new entertainment district by a vote of 5-3 at last night's meeting. The approved ordinance permits alcoholic beverages to be carried outside of participating businesses and be consumed within the downtown district between 11 a.m. and 10 p.m. daily, so long as the beverage is contained in a designated cup. Jeff Brown, owner of the Odd Soul, says the ordinance will bring people downtown, which will help local business owners. The bar owner says his business has been all but closed for 6 months.
I really do endorse this, and I ask that you can kind of throw us a bone, as some of us business people. We need the help. We need to find a way to make things work slightly differently than we have been. We went from being a beer parlor to a delivery pizza service in about 5 days. We had pizza anyways. We've been doing it for a year. But all of a sudden, it was the only thing we could do.
Boundaries for the downtown Springdale Outdoor Dining District will be designated by signs. The district encompasses Emma Avenue from Shiloh Street to Water Street. It goes as far north as Johnson Avenue and as far south as Grove Avenue. An emergency clause allows the ordinance to go into effect immediately. The ordinance creates the district for a 6-month observation period. Last year, the state legislature passed a law that allows cities and towns to establish entertainment districts. A number of cities around the state have since created their own entertainment districts, including El Dorado, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Little Rock, Mountain Home, and North Little Rock. Voters are backing Bethel Heights annexation into Springdale. The measure passed yesterday with 81% of ballots in favor of the small town being assumed into Springdale. Just fewer than 1,800 people voted in the special election. That will add more than 2,700 residents to Springdale's population. Of the voters in Springdale who cast ballots, about 90% were in favor of the annexation. Residents of Bethel Heights who voted approved the concept 268 to 154. The Symphony of Northwest Arkansas will be led by D. Riley Nicholson. SONA selected Nicholson to be the new executive director this week. He replaces Matthew Herron, who left to become the executive director of the Harrisburg Symphony Orchestra after 6 years at SONA. Nicholson is a native of Hot Springs and has a Master in Music Composition from the San Francisco Conservatory of Music and two Bachelors in Music from Memphis University. SONA has announced that three 2020 concerts are not taking place because of the pandemic, but the symphony is scheduled to be back on stage January 30th. And last month, former President Bill Clinton spoke at the funeral of Congressman John Lewis in Atlanta. The former president praised the work of Lewis throughout the congressman's life as a mentor, activist, politician, and community leader. During his eulogy, President Clinton mentioned Representative Lewis's successor to the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Stokely Carmichael, who later became Kwame Ture. President Clinton's comments about Ture were criticized by some for dismissing Ture's influence and views. For this week's Reflections in Black, Raven Cook, the founder and president of Foundations Black History Educational Programming, tells us more about the man whose birth name was Stokely Carmichael.
This is Reflections in Black, and I'm your host, Raven Cook. Reflections in Black is a segment dedicated to exploring the legacy of Black Americans in the United States and around the globe. Reflections in Black also provides resources for understanding and hope for all people. Black Power is a call for Black people in this country to unite, to recognize their heritage, to build a sense of community. It is a call for Black people to define their own goals, to lead their own organizations. Born on June 29, 1941, in Trinidad and Tobago, Stokely Carmichael exploded on the scene in the late 1960s, introducing the larger world to the term and concept Black Power. In 1952, Stokely Carmichael joined his parents Adolphus and Mabel Carmichael in Harlem, New York, after they immigrated to the United States. And in 1954, he himself would become a naturalized citizen. He graduated from the elite Bronx High School of Science in 1960 and then entered Howard University in D.C., studying philosophy. Galvanized by the energy of the sit-in demonstrations happening throughout the country, Carmichael joined the movement and became a freedom rider in 1961. While acting as a freedom rider, Carmichael would be arrested and sent to Parchman Prison in Mississippi and would apply the tactics of nonviolence. After being released from prison, he would continue his work in organizing and mobilizing Black Americans for change, serving in major campaigns like Freedom Summer and the early movements of SNCC, or the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. In 1966, Carmichael would take a leadership role as chairman of SNCC after the tenure of John Lewis. The period was critical. Many of the organizers had grown weary of the movement and the United States political system at large, including Carmichael. But a radical ideology of Black Power would provide new hope to Black America and a new energy to the civil rights movement. In the summer of 1966, leaders from all major civil rights organizations would travel to Mississippi to continue a march called A Walk Against Fear, begun by James Meredith, a leader in the fight for school integration. Carmichael would be joined by titans of the movement, particularly Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Throughout the day of June 16, 1966, SNCC organizers had begun encouraging people to use the phrase Black Power. And that warm Mississippi evening, Carmichael yelled to the crowd, "We've been saying freedom for 6 years. What we are going to start saying is Black Power." A cadence of Black Power echoed through the crowd, eventually through the United States and around the world. But Black Power as a concept then had to be defined, and this would lead to the text Black Power, the Politics of Liberation in 1968, which he wrote with Charles V. Hamilton. Stokely Carmichael would continue building the concept of Black Power, traveling around the world and speaking to leaders in African, Asian, and South American countries. He would also become an outspoken critic of the war in Vietnam and actively participate in the anti-war demonstrations of the day. As an organizer, he would work on the Lowndes County Freedom Party in Alabama, helping mobilize Black Americans to register and vote. And even for a brief time, he worked with the Black Panther Party for self-defense. Paying homage to African leaders Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana and Sékou Touré of Guinea, Carmichael would rename himself Kwame Touré. A hero and critical figure in helping how Black Americans see their beauty and translate that into political power, Carmichael's triumphant life would end in 1998 as he lost his battle with prostate cancer at the age of 57. Nevertheless, we celebrate the incredible life, legacy, and memory of the inspiring, the revolutionary Kwame Touré, or Stokely Carmichael.
Reflections in Black is a production of KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville. You can hear weekly segments on Ozarks at Large, and you can find past editions of the program at KUAF.com. Just search Reflections in Black.
This is Ozarks at Large. We're using the trails in Northwest Arkansas more. A recent report commissioned by the Walton Family Foundation indicates more people are biking, running, and walking on the trails, especially on the Razorback Regional Greenway that stretches through Benton and Washington counties. Karen Minkle, the Home Region Program Director for the Walton Family Foundation, says traffic on the Greenway and trails connected to the Greenway has been tracked since 2015. She says in 2019, there was a 36% growth in cycling compared to 4 years previously. And the increase comparing 2017 to 2019, 10%. There's also been a 2% increase in pedestrian traffic. And Karen Minkle, who we talked to last week via Zoom, says these numbers represent pre-pandemic use of the trails.
So we were seeing this increase prior to an event that I think actually has significantly increased activity across all of our public spaces.
I noticed that cycling activity is more prevalent during the weekend. Pedestrian earlier in the week. Any ideas? I mean, cycling on the weekend, I think, okay, we can kind of understand that, but pedestrians earlier in the week? That seems to me counterintuitive.
I think it's an interesting point of data in this study. I'll be curious to see what that looks like in future years. So I can't say that that's been the trend all along. I would say that generally the usage suggests that the trails are used more for recreational purposes. So you see people using them on the weekends or in the evenings versus during peak commute times.
Is there a way to know how much is being used for recreation and how many people are using it for transportation?
You can suss that out if you were doing intercept surveys at some point during the study to sort of randomly ask people their purpose. That wasn't a part of this study. So what we do know is when people are using the system, and then that gives us some indication. I will say that, our hypothesis is that it's used more for recreation just when we look at the peak times. And one of our other hypotheses is that we need a seamless connection between the trail network and safe streets so that people can get door to door when they're going to work or to school or coming home from a destination. And that would really enable this system to truly become an alternative transportation mode for a bigger part of the population. I'm confident some people are using it to commute, but I think for most people, they don't feel that they can get safely for door to door.
And that's part of the future planning, right? Is to make that seamless network, to make it more of a true alternative to a car?
I think it's not just the future. I think it's happening now because there are leaders across the community who recognize this. And as they're thinking about the design of streets, whether because they're new streets or they're reconstructing them in some cases or redesigning them, they are taking into account all the different ways in which the public will use the street. And it often includes different modes of transportation, whether that's walking, biking, cars. But I think more and more people are beginning to think about how a mass transit could use the street as well.
Is there other work that needs to be done, other projects or miles or connectors?
Yeah, you know, there have been a number of studies, both at the regional level as well as the individual municipal level, that flag the streets that are going to be these important connectors. And I think in some ways it's fairly intuitive. You're trying to connect people to the most popular destinations. So you can look at employment centers and as well as destinations like a Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, where you have significant traffic and where people would... where there's incentives for people to not drive because it's hard to find parking or it's expensive or cumbersome, or, you know, traveling there by bike is part of a beautiful experience. I think one of the loveliest stretches of the Greenway is actually from downtown Bentonville to Crystal Bridges, kind of that segment of trail. And so I think that I've had more than one person remark to me that approach has felt part of the art experience.
I know that in transportation circles, there's that term, the last mile, right? Bus lines, subways, whatever, don't work if you can't get people to that last mile so they're close enough. Is that something that is also thought about in trail work?
The way I would think about it is more as an overall system. So what is your what does your transportation system look like and what are all the possibilities? And I think that the paved trails are part of that conversation and really thinking about how all of these things connect. And I remember there was a transportation planner once was working in the region, and he talked about how you think about all the places where people want to go and need to go, and then think about the best way for them to get there in terms of mode, what's going to be the most efficient and safest form of travel for them. Ideally, you have a system where your transportation modes are integrated in a pretty seamless way. So whether that means you're on a bike and then you can easily take a major road and feel safe because you're on a protected bike path, or you have some form of transit where you can easily, you know, put your bike on a bus and take the bus directly to your destination. So I think there are a lot of ways to think about it. And I would say it's thinking about the entire system. And, you know, I think in most systems where you have more options and choices, the more efficient your system will be.
Darren Minkel is the Home Region Program Director for the Walton Family Foundation, and she talked with us via Zoom last week. She says right now there are 484 total miles of trails in Benton and Washington counties. 322 miles are natural surface trails. 162 are multi-use paved paths. She also says new trails in Bella Vista are experiencing a surge of use in 2020. Natural surface trails in that city have shown a 105% increase in average monthly traffic compared to last year. Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, a new book designed to help the youngest students in Arkansas schools better understand the weird school environment that awaits them. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda talks with Nikki Edge, who co-authored My Teacher Wears a Mask. That and much more on tomorrow's show at noon and 7 p.m. on 91.3. And if you hear us discuss an upcoming story that you aren't able to hear, that's okay. We have you covered. You can sign up for a daily free email delivery that provides links to each story from our daily show. To sign up, did I mention it was free? To sign up, just go to KUAF.com.
People in Lebanon have been protesting against their government ever since a devastating explosion in Beirut. Could that be giving some citizens hope?
There's so much positive energy. This population deserves so much better than what it has right now.
Also, how an open letter to Joe Biden led to Kamala Harris's nomination on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition, tomorrow morning from 5 to 9 on 91.3 KUAF, your public radio station. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Lowell. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to this Wednesday night edition of our show included Jacqueline Froelich, Zuzana Sitek, Antoinette Grajeda, who provided sound and information about Springdale's adoption of an outdoor entertainment district, and Raven Cook. Timothy Dennis produced and mastered the show from his home studio in downtown Fayetteville. Our theme is titled First Hurrah, and it is written and performed by Daryl Sean. You can find out more about Daryl at his webpage, darylsean.com. He's often found on his Facebook and Instagram feeds as well. His most recent CD titled Safe in Sound. And a friendly reminder, you can always support your public radio station in the way you choose, in the amount you choose, by going to supportkuaf.com. If you'd like to hear more content from Ozarks at Large, perhaps something you've missed over the past couple of days, you can go to ozarksatlarge.com. And there are many ways to hear the entire show on your schedule. You can ask your smart speaker to play Ozarks at Large, and then you'll hear the most recent edition. You can also go to ozarksatlarge.com and find the show there. Finally, we're available as a free podcast. It's fed through all the major podcast distributors including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, all of the biggies. All right, we'll be back with you tomorrow at noon for another brand new show. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio in the Carver Center for Public Radio, I'm Kyle Kellums. Thank you so much for being with us for part of your Wednesday night. Back tomorrow at noon. Please stay well.